Australia is the greatest nation on earth. And at the referendum last year, Australians told the elites they want to keep it that way. Is 2024 the year mainstream Australians continue to secure our way of life, or will the elites strike back? In season 3 of Australia's Future, former Prime Minister Tony Abbott will share his unique insight on the future of the Australian way of life. Hi everyone, welcome back Tony to season 3 of Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. It's great to be back for a big year. 2024 will be incredibly important to our nation's future. We've had a big 2023 with the defeat of the Voice to Parliament, and we're looking forward to the year ahead. There is no one better to get their insights and assessment of the future of our nation than former Prime Minister and, more importantly, distinguished fellow of the IPA, Tony Abbott. Tony, happy New Year and happy Australia Day to you.
Well, thanks, Dan. It's lovely to be back talking to you on a regular basis, and it's wonderful to be here on the eve of Australia Day to celebrate what remains the greatest country on earth, certainly the best country on earth to live. And our challenge is to keep it that way. And the great tragedy at the moment is that so many Australians who should know better in the corporate world, in the sporting world, in the political world, keep running our country down and keep angsting about our history, angsting about our National Day. I say to the people who won't let this go, please get over it. There is no better day to celebrate our country than the 26th of January, because it was back on the 26th of January 1788 that modern Australia began. There is no better date to celebrate our country than this one. So let's stop all of this breastbeating, all of the sanctimony, get on with acknowledging that whatever faults we have, we're a great country, and our challenge is to make a great country even better.
Well said, Tony. A great way to kick off our season 3. So we'll be talking about Australia Day. Let's just roll straight into it. So what you've just said then is what Australians agree with. Some polling we put out recently found 63% of Australians support Australia Day on the 26th. Only 17% want to change the date. But as you've just identified, there's the usual suspects, the activists, the big corporates that are dividing us and diminishing our National Day. Why, you know, reflecting on your time as leader and your extensive involvement in public life, why do they do this? Why are these corporates always taking one side of the political debate?
Look, there are some people who just want to try to keep everyone happy, and they are trying to appease an activist class which will never be happy. There's the Indigenous activists who really want special treatment for everyone with a bit of Indigenous ancestry, and they're going to keep up their campaign of Invasion Day. And then, of course, there's the cultural Marxists who don't like Australia, they don't like our democracy, they don't like our market capitalism, they don't like our Judeo-Christian ethic, they don't like the fact that we're part of the Anglosphere. And nothing that we do is going to satisfy those people. And that's why it is such a mistake for well-intentioned, polite people and, I suppose, self-serving, virtue-signalling people to keep pandering to it. I mean, let's look at the alternatives. I suppose we could, at a pinch, celebrate on the 1st of January, which was the anniversary of the formal inauguration of the Commonwealth of Australia back in 1901. But we didn't actually have, at the Commonwealth level initially, votes for women. Certainly, the initial Commonwealth was not as sympathetic to Aboriginal people as it subsequently becomes. So there are issues with that day. We could choose Anzac Day, but the same people who say that Australia Day is the celebration of invasion and the celebration of disposition would then no doubt say that Anzac Day is a celebration of imperialism and warmongering. So there is no better day than the day we've got. We have been celebrating one way or another on the 26th of January, ever since Governor Macquarie's time, the 30th anniversary, I believe, of the raising of the flag and the toasting of the King at Sydney Cove was celebrated back in 1818 under Governor Macquarie, and we should just keep doing it. Keep doing it. And I would like to see something that puts an end to all this agonising, whether that's legislation, just confirming that Australia Day will be on the 26th of January, with perhaps some kind of special entrenchment provision like we've had with the GST law, et cetera. I think it's absolutely time for us to put the annual agoniste over Australia Day behind us and get on with celebrating our country, which deserves to be celebrated at least as much as any other country on earth and more than most. And the fact that we now have a slightly higher than average proportion of Indigenous people in the parliament shows that Indigenous people are fully part of the Australian mainstream. It shows that we are bending over backwards to try to do the right thing by the first Australians. The fact that we are attracting millions of migrants all the time from the four corners of the earth demonstrate that this is a great country. Certainly, it's never been less racist. It's never been more colourblind. And in these respects, it's better than most and as good as anywhere.
Yeah, there's a couple of key points there, Tony. I mean, one is you're right about the dates. When there's people who say, well, they want to change the date, they don't want to change the date, they want to cancel the date for the reasons you've just outlined. They know that if they move it from the 26th, then people won't have the same attachment to the to the day, and that's the point. Just on to your point about what can be done, I know that there's, I think it was Henry Pike, MP, had a private members bill around. Basically, if you want to change the date of Australia Day, it could only be done
by plebiscite.
By plebiscite. Yeah. Now, I think the last thing Australians want is another plebiscite right now. But I think that on the face of it is a good idea and would probably put to rest some of the angst that exists on that matter. Do you sort of share that view, or would there be other approaches you might take?
I think Henry is very much on the right track. We do need something decisive that will put all this agonising behind us, because it's demeaning to our country, frankly, and it must be very confusing to overseas visitors who are here because they know what a great place it is, and yet we seem to be constantly angsting over it all. So I think Henry's absolutely on the right track, and I hope that the next coalition government will look at something like this, because we can't go on as we are.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of hope there, because Peter Dutton has been exemplary on this matter and on a number of other matters. His call for a boycott of Woolworths, I think, was spot on. Australians, I mean, I think they look to you and your time as leader as someone who stood up for Australia and would actually defend our values. And now I think in Peter Dutton they have someone else who would give them a voice, and they're desperate for this sort of leadership. So I thought his call was excellent, and I think it shows how far we've come on the centre-right. The idea even 1 or 2 years ago that a leader of a major centre-right party would call for a boycott of a big corporate was probably unimaginable. But with the defeat of The Voice, the fact that these corporates are becoming woker by the day has emboldened, I think, Peter Dutton and the centre-right. So just interested in your perspective on the call for a boycott and what it means for the future.
Well, it's not like Woolies are the only place we can go to get our groceries and things. And frankly, the only way that the general public have to punish an out-of-control, over-the-top corporate, which is lecturing people rather than serving people, is to say, well, I'll go and shop somewhere else. Now, I'd like to think that the Woolies board and the Woolies management will wake up to themselves. But interestingly, along with quite a few other elite groups, rather than heed the message of the Voice referendum last year, they've been doubling down on their virtue signalling and doubling down on their commitment to Indigenous separatism. I mean, let's not forget that Woolies was one of the many big public companies that gave a massive amount of money to the Yes campaign. I think Woolies, from memory, gave $1.5 million of shareholders' money to the Yes campaign. They're not stocking Australia Day-themed merchandise. They ostentatiously made a big look at me announcement about this.
Yeah.
And really, I mean, business should avoid virtue signalling on social and political issues. Business should stick to its knitting, which is to provide a good service, to do the right thing by their customers and to do the right thing by their staff. And I'd imagine that Woolies customers and Woolies staff, in common with the rest of the community, would have voted something like 60% against separatism, against seeing our history as a story of shame rather than pride in the referendum last year. And I reckon it's way past time for management and the board to heed that message.
I think that's right. I mean, there's a pretty ingrained issue. I talked about this on the Bolt Report a week or so ago, which is when you look at the actual board of Woolworths, so there's 9 on the board, including the CEO, 4 out of the 9 are also on boards of other woke companies that gave to The Voice. You know, companies like Telstra, like Qantas, like ANZ, like NAB. So this, it's just this circle, this revolving door at the top of our economic society where they're just, they're totally out of touch with their customer base. And I think that they believe that their views are the views that are shared by a majority simply because the people they interact with reinforce their views back to them. So it really is a detached ecosystem that they occupy. Has that changed in your time in public life? It feels to me that it's become a lot worse over the last, say, 3-4 years. I'm just interested in your perspective on how corporate Australia has drifted.
It's a very good question, Dan. And look, I don't know that we have any hard statistics, but my guess is that if you were to poll the directors of public companies, you would find quite different voting intentions today than would have been the case a generation or two back. Yeah. I'm very conscious of the fact that public companies, which once made substantial political donations to the side of politics which most supports business, are no longer doing that. To the extent that public companies make any political donations these days, and it's limited, they tend to support both sides equally. So I think there has been a change in the political orientation of boards. Maybe the union super fund's place in share registries has helped to drive that. Maybe it's, if you like, the, I guess, just the standard increasing gulf between elites and mainstream Australians. Maybe it's the fact that salary levels at the top levels of business are much greater multiples of the salary levels at the shop floor today than they were a generation or so back. I mean, when you think that, okay, maybe the average Woolies worker would be earning, say, you know, 60 or 70 grand a year, very modest pay. I'd be surprised if the CEO isn't on a couple of million plus. So at least 20 or 30 times what the shop floor people are earning. That wouldn't have been the case a generation ago, certainly wouldn't have been the case a generation ago. So I think all of these factors are feeding in, and I just think that it's way past time for the people who are calling the shots in our major institutions, whether it's big business, big universities, big sport, big tech. It's way past time for these people to do better, to reconnect with the average person. And whether it's making sure you walk the shop floor every day, as someone like Roger Corbett used to do when he was the CEO of Woolies, whether it's occasionally getting in a truck and driving as your staff do, as people like Lindsay Fox used to do. I just think it's important for the people at the top of all of these enterprises to try to ensure that they have not lost touch with the people who make them work.
On the Woolworths issue, you mentioned that sort of the CEO has been going around saying, oh, it's a commercial decision. And we all know that's not the case, because they said in their original statement, well, it was due to declining demand. Mm. And of course, they provided no evidence to support that. Mm. But they also said something to the effect of there's a broader discussion happening about Australia Day, which is clearly a political statement. Mm-hmm. In some polling that we just did on this matter, only 22% are buying the spin from the CEO of Woolworths that it was a commercial decision, with the rest saying it was purely political or a combination of both. What's interesting to me is we've just seen over the last couple of days that both the CEO of Woolworths and also the head of Cricket Australia sort of backtrack a little bit. So the head of Cricket Australia went from saying, we're not going to talk about Australia Day, to confirming on Ben Fordham's show, I think it was, that we will say Australia Day at the cricket. Now, that's not what we want, but it's a modest back down. You've had the Woolies CEO going out there saying, oh, well, you know, we like Australia Day. This is all about commercial decision and so forth. So there has been a partial back down, I think in part because of what Dutton did, and in part because, you know, we have to fight. If we don't defend our day, we will lose. And I think this is an example of how when mainstream Australians push back, we do see a bit of ground being given. Again, not as much as we want, but I think something positive has happened over the last couple of days. What do you reckon?
I think there's a lot in that. I've often found myself saying that a silent majority that remains silent will not long remain a majority. And I think that too many of us have been too silent for too long out of a misplaced sense of politeness. We haven't spoken up against things which we know are folly because we don't want to upset our neighbours, our workmates, our bosses, our kids, whoever it might be. And so we've gone along with, you know, the climate cult, we've gone along with the gender fluidity push, we've gone along with the Let's Change Australia Day push, we've gone along with so many of these follies. But I think a lot of people are starting to say enough is enough, and certainly all credit to Peter Dutton. Peter, in opposing The Voice, particularly at a time when it still looked more likely than not that The Voice would succeed, was showing the kind of courage and principle from a centre-right political leader, which has been all too rare over the last decade or so.
Indeed. Tony, we might leave the chat about Australia Day there for the moment and move on to another key topic, which is just as you and I were discussing before we went on, was the Stage 3 tax cuts and the debate about that. So this is still a developing matter, but these fairly significant tax cut program was implemented in 2018 under the coalition government, but legislated over multiple years, which I think, you know, perhaps was, in my view, not the right thing. I think if you're going to do it, you should do it all at once, but I understand from a budgetary position why they did that. But basically, we've seen Albanese, who's all but confirmed that they're going to roll back at least a part of that by keeping that 37% tax rate rather than removing it. And that was one of the key linchpins of that Stage 3 tax cut reform. What Albanese has basically said is, look, we're going to have a less generous tax cut to those on 180 or 160 or 200 grand and a more generous tax cut to those at the lower end of the scale. Clearly, this is a broken promise. There's no doubt about that. And he's not even pretending that it's not a broken promise. I don't know how Australians will receive this. I think that they'll be open to it in a sense, but it's going to be an interesting debate. But just very interested in your perspective on the economics and the politics of this.
Well, there are two issues, aren't there? The first is he's rolling back something that was an economic reform, not a vast economic reform, but nevertheless, the most significant economic reform under the Morrison government, which he and his party, however reluctantly, supported at the time. So the idea that we should flatten the tax rate is a good one.
Yep.
And as proposed, these tax cuts were going to give a 30% tax rate to something like 95% of all taxpayers, earning between $45,000 and $200,000 a year. That's no longer going to happen, and I think that's most unfortunate. But probably the bigger issue is that this is a total breach of faith. The Labor Party supported these things when they were announced in the 2019 budget. The Labor Party supported it at the 2019 election, supported the 2022 election. The Labor Party voted for it when it went through the Parliament after the 2019 election. The Prime Minister and the Treasurer, at least on the Coalition's count, have explicitly supported the Stage 3 tax cuts on almost 100 specific occasions. Now, I just think it's dead wrong for a political group to say one thing before an election and do something very different after an election, unless there is some very compelling reason for change, which is clearly explained to people. Now, the only real explanation for this is abiding class war, politics of envy sentiments inside large elements of the Labor Party, and an incorrigible resistance to doing anything that the Morrison government proposed. Now, my anxiety is that if they can't bring themselves to see through the Stage 3 tax cuts, does this mean they're suddenly going to have at a critical moment a same hubristic attack on something like AUKUS, for instance? Because again, this was fundamentally the work of the Morrison government. Again, it was supported, perhaps reluctantly, but it was supported by the ALP in opposition. I think that the AUKUS schema that the Albanese government put forward last year is a good one. Getting the American nuclear submarines first and then obtaining the Anglo-Australian nuclear submarines down the track, I think that's a good schema. But if they couldn't bring themselves in the end to put into place the Morrison policy on tax, Let's hope they don't have a similar attack of the wobbles on AUKUS at some point in the future.
Yeah, it's a good point. And to me, it seems like really a make or break moment for Albanese. I mean, clearly he spent the summer, understandably given his political situation, wanting desperately to turn the focus on cost of living, middle Australia, who are upset with the fact that he wasted all that time on the Voice referendum, many of whom voted against it. 37% of Labor voters voted no, which is extraordinary. I think if he is able to get these through, the plan or the thinking there would be that it'll be the start of the turn of his fortunes. Now, it may not be, I don't know, but that would be the thinking. But if this goes down or if he backtracks or if there's rumblings from in the court and Labor caucus, then he could be in a lot of trouble. So I see this as really, he's trying to set up the year, a clear political contest with Dutton. Just interested, I mean, you were a master really of setting up contests that unite your party and divide the others. Do you think this, just from a purely leadership perspective, do you think this is a wise course of action from Albanese, or do you believe that he's going down the wrong road and he'll regret it?
Well, I think he will regret it. I think he'll regret it very much, because he could have given more to low-income earners without taking away from higher-income earners the tax cuts that they had been repeatedly promised and which had gone into LAW law. Yes, it would have cost the budget a bit more, but he's boasting about budget surpluses. So, and as we know, the big expense when it comes to tax cuts, the big cost to the revenue, if you like, is the tax cuts at the lower end, where there are lots of taxpayers, not the tax cuts at the higher end, where there are relatively few taxpayers. I mean, we have to appreciate that at the moment, the bulk of income tax comes from higher income earners. The top 10% of income earners pay something like 50% of income tax. By contrast, the bottom 50% of income earners pay something like 10% of income tax. So the danger when you effectively increase the tax burden on the top income earners is that sooner or later you're going to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. There has to be reasonable incentives for our best and most productive people economically to keep coming up with good ideas, to keep working hard, to keep employing. And every time government dangles something in front of them and says, look, here is something that you can aspire to, and then snatches it away just when they're about to get it, it's telling the aspirational people of Australia the effort's hardly worth it. So apart from the fact that it's a serious breach of faith, apart from the fact that it's rolling back a modest but important economic reform, it is saying to the aspirational people, we don't really care about you. And that's a dangerous sentiment for a government to propagate.
Well, Tony, I think that's a good note for us to leave it on for our first episode back for season 3 in 2024. So greatly appreciate your time and insights as always, and really looking forward to the chats throughout this year. It's going to be a big year as we head up to the federal election and a lot of other issues. So thank you again, and looking forward to the year ahead.
Me too, Dan.
This is a production of the Centre for the Australian Way of Life at the Institute of Public Affairs. To find out more, visit australia.ipa.org.au.